All right. Again, thank you all. I see a couple other people have joined us. Let's see the Potters, Joy, Kathy Holmes, and Rebecca. Great to have you all on here today. All right. So we are in the Gospel of Mark. Still, I wonder. But we have just finished talking about the healing of the epileptic in Mark chapter 9, and we're going to continue looking at the second prediction of his death that Jesus makes. He makes this first prediction earlier on in chapter 8, and he makes a second prediction there in verses 30 through 32. So chapter 9, verses 30 through 32, he makes a second prediction concerning his death, and we'll look at that in just a moment. But before we do, we note that this is looking at this particular diagram. We're moving from this section now to this section. So we've looked at that first section that talks about his death, and how it relates to the kingdom being near, particularly in Mark chapter 9 and verse 1, and also all the way back in chapter 1, verses 14 and 15. Now we're going to look at this other section here, and we're going to recognize that there is some correlation with the second section of the first part of the Gospel of Mark, where the kingdom has small beginnings. We note that there in chapter 4, that he is that we're looking at the parables, the various parables of the church, of the kingdom, of the good news, of the gospel, and we note that it has small beginnings, and then that is the case as well as we see here in this section in chapter. In this next section at the rest of chapter 9 and also a good chunk of chapter 10. And we'll note that connection as we get there. But first, let us consider this particular prediction. Let's go ahead and oops. There we go. Let's go ahead and read this now. Let me pull myself back up. Bring me over here. All right. So let's look at this section here, this three verses 30 through 32. Then they departed from here from there and passed through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know it, for he taught his disciples and said to them, "The Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And after he is killed, he will rise the third day." But they did not understand this saying and were afraid to ask him. So they did not understand. Let's consider the fact that they are moving through Galilee at this moment. All right, we see that we see that they're moving through Galilee. Jesus, it says that he's moving from his location, wherever he's at, through Galilee. He travels he's traveling either from Caesarea Philippi. Of course, this all depends on where the Transfiguration takes place. If you think the Transfiguration takes place at Mount Hermon, then he's going from Caesarea Philippi through Galilee. If you think that it's taking place at Mount Tabor, then it's one of the villages around Mount Tabor that this is occurring, and he's moving from there, and he's going through Galilee. And they're going to end up going to Capernaum. In any event, it's clear that his intention was to go through this region unnoticed. All right, so Mount Tabor, we'll note, is actually not far, or is actually in Galilee. It's not far from Nazareth. So you'll note down here, there is Mount Tabor down here, and Nazareth is right over here. So you see these two right here, and they're not far. So he would have healed the epileptic near there, near Mount Tabor, and no more than likely garnering a whole lot more attention than he would have otherwise. If he were in Caesarea Philippi, as we see in the yellow up there, which is north of Galilee, then it might have been easier traveling through Galilee unnoticed. And that's my thought on there. In Mark chapter 9 in verse 33, we note that they arrive at Capernaum. So what this would mean is that they would be backtracking quite a bit if they had been around Mount Tabor. All right, and so if so, here's the path they would have taken if he was coming from Mount Hermon. He would have come down Mount Hermon, backtracked the way he had come through Caesarea Philippi. Again, Caesarea Philippi is, my opinion, likely where the epileptic was healed, and going down through, likely back through Bethsaida, and then going to Capernaum. So that's one scenario. If the transfiguration takes place at Mount Tabor, then he'd be going up through Galilee and going up back and backtracking. In any event, he has his eyes set on Judea and Jerusalem, which is evidenced by this second prediction that was made, that Jesus had made here. So he is either this is either on the way from Caesarea Philippi, or this is on the way from Mount Tabor. In any event, he's traveling through Galilee. And so some evidence for the Mount Tabor is that he's not really traveling much through Galilee if he's coming from Caesarea Philippi. So there's some evidence on that end. In any event, he's traveling through and he's wanting to do so unnoticed. And we know from past readings and whatnot that that's very difficult for him because he is a well-known, very famous preacher by this point. All right. Now we're going to look at so he's going through Galilee, and now we're going to look at this idea that he was teaching. He was teaching. Now why do I say was teaching? Well, that's kind of an important thing here because in the New King James it says, "For he taught his disciples," but that's not entirely what the tense is here in Greek. Well, here we see that the reason he wanted to pass through unnoticed, the reason he wanted to pass through unnoticed is because he wanted to teach his disciples about what was about to happen. That would be difficult if there was a huge throng coming around them and trying to get him to heal them and get his attention. So that'd be very difficult in that event. So all the while he's passing through Galilee, he was teaching and saying what we read here in verse 31. The Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and after he is killed, he will rise the third day. So these verbs that are here, he taught and he said, these are what's called in the this is the imperfect tense. The imperfect tense. If you're not familiar with that, this is an indication that this is a continued action in the past. When I was in learning foreign languages, we were taught that if you wanted to have the imperfect tense, you could translate that in one of four ways. He was doing something, he continued to do something, he kept on doing something, or he used to do something. Well, I don't think used to quite fits in this particular context, but he was teaching. He continued to teach. He kept on teaching. This was not just a one-time teaching during this traveling. This is something he's continually doing. He's trying to impress upon his disciples about what is going to happen. And it's summarized here in verse 31. All right. So he was again teaching about his death and subsequent resurrection that was going to happen 3 days later. He says, "Rise the third day." Again, these predictions are so important because it shows that he knew this was going to happen, and that when it did happen, people could say, "Wow, he knew this was going to happen. He must be the Son of God." All right. What he adds a particular detail here in Mark chapter 9, verse 31, that isn't in chapter 8, verse 31. And this is the idea that he was going to be betrayed. Really, it says he is being betrayed. This is a present tense verb, not, and so that he is saying he is being betrayed. So this is again present tense, indicating that this is an ongoing event. This Greek word for betrayed has a more basic meaning, to be delivered up. So some versions might have that. And I wonder, the disciples, all 12 of them, are hearing this, including Judas Iscariot, the one who would betray him. So a question that I have: what do you suppose is going through Judas's mind during this time? What do you think is going through Judas's mind? I mean, he's about to, we know that he's about to betray Jesus because we know the story. But the other disciples didn't know that. Jesus knew that through his ability to know the future and to see into men's hearts. What do you suppose is going on through Judas's mind? Now, I mean, do you suppose that he even knew that, or he had it in his mind that he was going to betray Jesus yet? Or is this some kind of new thing for Judas that he hadn't even thought about yet? Any thoughts? Okay. No thoughts on that. So, I'm hearing this. If I were Judas, and I'm thinking, if I have this idea that I'm going to betray Jesus, and I hear Jesus already knowing about that, I might get a little nervous. He knows about this? What's going on here? One commentator suggests that this is a reference to the Father. That the father was going to deliver him up to be killed. Not, it shouldn't be translated as betrayed, but as delivered up, that he was going to deliver up Jesus. He also states that Jesus is also the one who delivers himself up. So instead of a reference to Judas, some say that this is a reference to what the father is doing, delivering up, not betraying, but delivering up. Both Jesus himself doing that and or the father, or both, delivering him up to be sacrificed for us. So these are some possibilities that we see here. While those are interesting ways to look at it, we do know that Judas is going to betray him. So that sense of the word is indicated, is suggested here because of that knowledge. This is an ongoing thing, which may mean that Judas has already been thinking about this, or that the Pharisees, and here's another possibility, that the Pharisees themselves were plotting his death. Certainly, we know that they were plotting with the Herodians there in chapter 3 and verse 6. Maybe they were wanting to somehow corrupt Judas, and Judas had no idea about this yet, but it was something to that effect. Who knows? Who knows what exactly is happening here, but we do know that Jesus has some divine knowledge about this. And so I wouldn't be surprised at all if he knew ahead of time that that he was going to be this far in advance, he was going to be betrayed. All right. Then we see that the disciples, we see, are afraid to ask. They are afraid to ask about this, about all this, about what's going on here. The disciples, they're still unsure of what to make of these predictions. So Jesus had rebuked Peter the last time. They're in Acts chapter 8, verses 32 and 33. And perhaps they finally learned, especially Peter, that silence is the best response. They just don't know what to say, and so they're going to keep quiet. Maybe they finally learned that. Maybe they are thinking. Maybe they're just well, I lost my train of thought. Maybe they're just not sure what to say, and so they should be trying to ask questions to see about this, but maybe they're just not thinking straight. I don't know. Yeah, Sam?
I think one of the things too that so much of Jesus, was teaching in parables and talking about things in different terms. He says, well, you heard it this way in the law of Moses, but I say this, that they very well could have just been saying, now, what does he actually mean by that? They weren't taking him, they may not have been taking him as literally as he was telling them, because he was telling them very plainly. So they may have just been saying, wow, I wonder what that means. The fact that it even says somewhere, it says, and if they talk to themselves about this, what this rising from the dead might mean, right? So they're trying to understand that. I think we always, because we've seen it, we've seen the story and we know about it. We know the whole story from end to end, that sometimes we think, man, these guys were pretty dull, but I don't know if they'd have done much better.
Yeah, I don't think we would have either. They're trying to piece all these clues together, and you're right. We do read in John chapter 16 toward the end that the disciples are saying, "Now you teach us. You're teaching us things plainly. Now you speak plainly." And so that takes place long after this event here in Mark 9. So maybe they're just not sure. They're just trying to piece it all together and trying to figure this out. Even though, at least what's being said here seems pretty plain to me. But again, we are looking at it in hindsight, and so it's hard to really divorce ourselves from looking at it in hindsight versus how they would have perceived it. So that's a good point, Sam. Thank you. All right, so next we're going to look at this section on humility and service. This section on humility and, oh, hello, Kitty. Humility and service. So again, chapter 9. There we go. Humility and service. So if you will, let's look at chapter 9, verses 33 through 37. And we'll read this and we'll talk about this. We did this morning, the sermon referenced one of these verses. And so it hopefully this dovetails nicely. All right, let us read. Then he came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What was it you disputed among yourselves on the road?" But they kept silent, for on the road they had disputed among themselves who would be the greatest. And he sat down, called the 12, and said to them, "If anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all." Then he took a little child and set him in the midst of them. And when he had taken him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one of these little children in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." All right. So, looking at this, let's see this first one. Let's consider where they're at. Of course, we do know that they're in Capernaum. They returned there, and again, if the Transfiguration were on Mount Hermon, then it makes sense that they would go back through in order to head toward Jerusalem, so that they could go through there, it's on the way, if you will, if they're in Mount Tabor. Then they would have had to backtrack to get to Capernaum. But since this is where Jesus' headquarters were, as we see in Matthew chapter 4 and verse 13, and this is then it's likely that he is, and we do see him in Capernaum quite often, then it's not inconceivable that he would want to return there to wrap some things up on his way to Jerusalem. Also, since we note in chapter 9 and verse 30 that they were passing through Galilee, they would have had to pass through more of it if they were at Mount Tabor. So trying to pinpoint where the Mount of Transfiguration is not an easy matter when it's not explicitly stated. But we do note here that they had entered into the house. It says right there that, and when he was in the house, he asked them, and this is a definite article that's used here, the definite article the. And so this is likely the house that he was based, which was, again, probably Peter's house. We see that in Mark chapter 1, verse 29, and also chapter 4, verse 13, where it says that Jesus's house. Or at least a lot of people think that Jesus had a house there. I tend to think that this was Peter's house that Jesus was using as his headquarters. One commentator suggested it could be Matthew's house, since in Matthew chapter 2 they were there. But in any event, I think this is probably Peter's house. All right. Let's see. Now let's look at who is the greatest. This is the dispute that they are having. Who is the greatest? So, this is Jesus. He's asking them a question. He asks them a question. What are you arguing about? What are you talking about? What are you arguing on the street there? Well, so my question, have you ever been in a situation, perhaps in school, where you and your friends were probably talking about something and then the teacher interrupts and says something along the lines of, Billy, why don't you share it with a class? Or something of that nature. Well, that shuts you up pretty quick, doesn't it? You don't want to, you're talking about something and it's not really meant for everyone to hear. Or maybe they want to ask you a question. You don't know the answer, and so you're quiet. It's like, I don't know. this is the kind of thing that happened here. The disciples likely knew that Jesus would not have approved of this particular discussion, so they kept silent. This must have been in between, of course, and must have been in between the moments when Jesus was talking about his death and resurrection. As we discussed before, the reason for asking questions could be to get information, but it could also be used to teach. Jesus typically uses his questions to teach, not to gain information. So Jesus already knew what they were talking about. He knew it one of two ways. He could overhear what they were saying. But we do know that he can read men's hearts. So that's very likely. He could have just been reading their hearts and try to figure out what they're thinking. Or again, because maybe the disciples weren't as quiet as they thought they were, and Jesus was able to overhear. In any event, the dispute they had was about who would be the greatest. They have 12 people there, and the obvious contenders are Peter, James, and John. I mean, they went with them to the heal Jairus' daughter. They went with him to the Mount of Transfiguration. So the obvious answers are those three, the obvious contenders. But that is not how they should be thinking about things. This is an understandable question. However, if you think about it from their perspective, I know we discussed earlier how it's difficult to think about things from their perspective, and it is. But we can try, and in one aspect, one characteristic, this is an understandable question that they had given what they thought they knew about the kingdom. Jesus had been predicting his death, at least twice by this point. And when they perhaps when they translated that in their minds, they were thinking he was about to restore the kingdom to Israel, as we see all the way down to Acts chapter 1 and verse 6. Even that late date, they thought that it was going to happen just like that. They wanted to know what their positions would be and who would be the greatest. Now, again, the obvious favorites are Peter, James, and John, but then which of those three? And then which of the other nine would be considered the greatest? Who knows? That was a question that they had. They were already afraid to ask him about his teaching that we saw in verse 32, but they were not afraid to talk about it amongst themselves. This would not be the last time Jesus talks about this topic, as we'll see the question that the sons of Zebedee, James and John, have of Jesus later on in chapter 10 and verse 37. And we'll look at that more in depth, at this topic more in depth when we get to that point. In any event, this is what one might call a paradoxical response. A paradoxical response. We've already looked at one paradox. First off, he sits down. We see in verse 35 that he sits down, which is what teachers did in those days. Today, teachers stand up, preachers stand up, but back then they sat down while everyone else stood up. This is he takes this posture with his disciples around him. And again, he utters this particular paradox, the last shall be first, that the last shall be first. Recall his earlier paradox, that those who desire to save their life will lose it. That was in chapter 8 and verse 35. While that was a paradox on commitment, this is a paradox on service and greatness. As Jesus is portrayed throughout Mark as a servant, he is providing his disciples with an example of the kind of service they also ought to practice. In doing so, he brings a child in their midst as an object lesson. We see in verse 36, then he took a little child and set him in the midst of them. He says, he grabs a child and says, "Here, here you go." My question, who is this child? Is just some random person that Jesus is picking off the street? Who is this person? Well, they're in a house, right? It says, who is this child? Why is there a child nearby? Well, again, I think they're in Peter's house, very likely. So this child is, in my opinion, probably Peter's child. It doesn't say, or perhaps it could be Peter's nephew or niece, as we see. This is also Andrew's house. We see all the way back in Mark chapter 1. That Jesus goes to Peter's house, but it doesn't say Peter's house, it's Peter's and Andrew's. Peter and Andrew's house. So this could be Peter's child or Andrew's child, or maybe someone else who lives in that household, another niece or nephew. All right. Even though, oh, yes, go ahead.
One thing that we don't think about a lot because we don't do it as much, but in our culture, but in many cultures, you have extended families. Someone will have a house and the children will add another room onto the house. We used to see that in Honduras all the time. You start with the original house that was the mom and dad's house, and then the children would grow up and one of them would add another room and one of them would add another room. So having, and of course, they didn't have any kind of birth control back then. They all had large families. There were lots of kids running around. So it's pretty likely that if they had a home, Peter and Andrew may very well have lived in the same space with some of the rest of their family, and there would have been lots of kids around.
And I think that's the point I was trying to make. I think we noted when we looked at Peter's house all the way back in Mark chapter 1 that it was a modestly sized house. It was not the house of a rich man by any means, but it wasn't a very small house either. And so again, that's likely because we note that Peter, Andrew, and Peter's mother-in-law lived there, at the very least. So that probably included Peter's wife. And we do know that Peter was married, as we see in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. But at the same time, he had a mother-in-law. So there's that. So they probably had children who were there in the house. Andrew may have been married and had children himself, and who knows who what other kids, what other brothers and sisters that Peter had who were living there. Probably brothers, I would imagine. I bet the sisters were living with their husband somewhere else. But the idea is, yes, you're right. They would have these extended family living in the same area. So it could be, again, Peter's child or a niece or nephew. You know, even though the English says him, it says that in verse, again, 36, and he took the little child and set him in the midst of them. Even though it says him in the English, the Greek is a little less clear about gender. When referring to children, Greek typically uses a neuter gender. And this is the case for the word child. Child is a neuter word. That doesn't mean children don't have gender, but what's the difference between a little boy and a little girl? They're both children. There's not, at least in their minds, there wasn't a whole lot of difference. So at least to some extent, of course, there was some issues with how they treated little girls versus little boys, but that's, in any event, this is how the language viewed children. At the same time, the pronouns referring back to child also are in the neuter. So, I mean, if we were going to be translating this literally, we would say it. But they, sorry, verse 36, then he took a little child and set it in the midst of them. Now, that's kind of rude in English. In our modern sensibilities, we don't think of people as its. So they assigned a him to it. So this could be a her. This could be a little girl or a little boy. There's no indication in the Greek either way. In any event, this is not the last time that Jesus refers to little children. Again, chapter 10, verses 13 through 16. He will end up talking about little children once again and talking about their humility. And so we'll definitely talk about that more when we get there. But again, we see here the humility of a child, which is a trait that we should emulate. What does 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and verse 20 say? 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and verse 20. It says, "Brethren, do not be children in understanding. However, in malice be babes, but in understanding be mature." So, they were, this is a similar thing that that Paul is talking about there. Not exactly, but the idea is there that certain characteristics that we should have are that or are similar to that of children. We shouldn't be malicious. We should lack malice like children lack malice. We should lack pride. We should be more humble, just as children are more humble. And it's really amazing just to see that with kids, just how readily they accept correction. And that's exactly how we need to be sometimes. All right. So this is such a humble. Such humble ones, we note here, such humble ones are to be received with open arms. To have a better idea of what that means, other translations say welcomes. So instead of receives, whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcomes not me, but him who sent me. So instead of so this is other translations say welcomes instead of receives. So when we do that, when we welcome the humble people, when we welcome children, we receive Jesus, and in turn we receive the Father as well. I want to talk about this idea for a little while and perhaps spend the rest of the time on this. About the idea of welcoming children. welcoming children. If you were paying attention to the description of this video, I typically put the discussion questions in here, and the second one on here is about what do we do about a crying child in worship service? So the question I have, I didn't want to put that on this first question on there, but this first question, do any of us scowl when we hear a baby crying out during worship? I agree that as the child ages, that he or she needs to be taught how to act in worship. But many times it just can't be helped. Having little children of my own, sometimes it can't be helped. They're gonna, especially the infants, they're just gonna cry out. I've been lucky to have really good babies, especially Seth. He would cry out sometimes, but most of the time he was very quiet. But I recognize that that's the exception, not the rule, for most children. In any event, there is a balance. We come to worship God, and it's hard to do when there are distractions, such as babies running around or talking or crying or making a fuss. So my question, and I have some thoughts on this, but I want to hear what thoughts that you all might have. And you can, of course, leave a comment so that we can talk about this as well. What is the best way to handle that situation? What is the best way to handle a rambunctious child in class, or not in class, but a rambunctious child in the worship service? We come to worship. We don't need to be. We don't want to be distracted, but again, the kids need to be there, and especially the parents need to be there. So, what is a good solution to this situation? Any thoughts?
Well, I would think that one, it's situational because there's a difference between a child who's just not feeling well, versus a child that's being rebellious. There's all kinds of aspects of that, and as parents, all of us who've been parents, we've had to deal with that, and you have to make judgment calls. Sometimes you have a sick child who's just feeling bad, or they're teething or something, and they're just feeling, upset and they're fussy. That's a very different thing than one that's literally throwing a fit because you told them to sit still and they're refusing to. I remember taking one of my daughters out one time, she was hollering all the way down the aisle. And that's a time when she needed some discipline. But it's very situational, and parents struggle with that all the time.
And my wife is remarkable for being able to handle that a lot, especially during the sermon while I'm preaching. So she's certainly a great that I'm sure that's hard to handle all that on your own, especially with more than one child. Let me start out by saying that I am opposed to the idea of any kind of divided assembly. And so thank you, Rebecca. I appreciate that. She says, good lesson, Stephen. I enjoyed it. And well, we're not over. Still got some time. So I am opposed. So a lot of churches will come up with a solution. I grew up with that so-called solution, and they called it children's church. The idea where you would take the children out of the regular worship service and have them set aside in a different place, and there would be a few adults in there watching the children, and they would be having some kind of children's activity there. Well, I am opposed to that idea, and here's why. First off, there's no example of that in scripture at all. No example of a divided assembly. They all came together to worship. Now, while the children might not be putting the same emphasis on worship as the adults are, they need to be taught that. And who better to teach them than their parents? Now, I will say that some people say, well, how about put them in this separate thing so that they can learn? Well, how about the people who are teaching them? They're not in there worshiping. They're doing this little children's worship, and that's just not the same either. And not only that, article after article has been written attributing this children's church idea as one of the reasons why the church has lost so many millennials, so many people of my age group. So that's another reason why I think it's probably not a good idea, because the fact that we're losing so many, and I think that's one of the reasons why. Why? Because we're not worshiping all together. While the learning curve may be steep for some parents, is what I mean, it's not impossible. So, another question, how do we best deal with that learning curve for, say, new members or visitors? I've been in a congregation where the there was this kid, I can't remember how old he was, older than Caroline, maybe 4 or 5, maybe a little older, and he was visiting with his mom, and I think had a couple of kids, the brother or sister, or some, but they were smaller and easier to manage. But he just went wild. So what do you do? What do you do in that situation where you have a child who is just so rambunctious, and the parent is new to this and doesn't know what to do? She or he, I mean, both the parents might be expecting some kind of children's church scenario, but there isn't one. So how do we handle that? Any thoughts?
With difficulty and lots of patience and love. But one of the things to keep in mind is there should be lots of other opportunities for teaching both new Christians and families about God and about behavior when we do come to worship. Very often people think, well, that's the only time that they're going to be taught. There's lots of other opportunities. I know we've been blessed here recently with these last year with some new Christians being converted. They have a lot of things to learn. They need to be taught, and they're not going to learn it all at once. And especially if their children have never had any expectation of how to behave in a worship assembly, they're not going to know either. And so it's one where a lot of patience and love is required, but also to take advantage of other opportunities and not expect that that's the only time they're going to be learning is when they're in the worship service.
Yeah, those are some good points too. Joy has a comment on here. She says, one church I attended de designated the back pews for families with little children, less distracting when crying or leaving for the nursery. And that's possible too, although that could get distracting for other people. Depends on the acoustics, depends on how I mean, you're right, it is less distracting, but it can, that's not a perfect solution, I think. In any event, I think I have some suggestions for how to handle that. And Sam, you're right too, with patience and prayer, and letting them know that there are other opportunities to take advantage of them learning about these things. Here are some thoughts that I have on what we could do, or what and we might do some of these things already. Always, I think we should always offer the nursery to new or visiting families. We notice that there's a family coming in, and they've got little children, perhaps even older children, Caroline's age or older, and we could say, "Hey, we've got this nursery in case you ever need it. We don't know if they'll need it or not, so just say we have this here. We got to make sure." That I think the speaker is working. Victoria has commented a couple times that sometimes the speaker wasn't on or wasn't working. So we got to make sure that that's the case. It's not ideal for the parents back there, but it's better than nothing. And I think this other suggestion I have kind of dovetails a bit with Sam's thought here. I think we need to encourage parents on how to keep their children quiet and still. And I think we need to follow the instructions of Titus chapter 2, verses 4 and 5. Those particular verses talk about how the older women are to teach the younger women how to love their children, love their husbands, love their children. And so one of the ways you love your child is you discipline them, right? And so you want to, so I think that's another thing that we ought to be able to do is have some of the older women take some of the younger women aside. And I don't mean this necessarily in physical age, but also spiritual age. Take the those who are more spiritually mature and have them go to the those who are not as spiritually mature and tell them how or encourage them and help them with whatever situation that they're facing. That little boy I mentioned that other church that I was at, I had taken him aside at some point because he was going around and I said, "Hey, why don't you sit with us?" And I don't remember if Seth was born yet, but I do know that Caroline was very small, and I knew Victoria had her. I don't think Seth was born yet. Caroline had her well in hand, and so I wasn't preaching at the time. So I took him and had him sit next to me, this little boy, and so he was fairly good then. And so that's another thing that we could potentially do. Yeah. Yeah.
Because if they, if they want to come and worship and they literally spend the whole time wrangling the child and don't even remember what was said, that's very, very discouraging for a parent in that situation. So it's a great opportunity for those of us who are grandparents in life or grandparents at heart to say, let him come sit with me, or let her come sit with me, and that sometimes changing that environment also helps with the child's situation as well, like you mentioned.
Yeah, and I want to apologize. I didn't unmute Sam right away. One of the things that he had said was that, especially for a young parent who's new to all this, they can't concentrate on the service and they're all frazzled and they're not getting anything out of it because of their kids. It's a good thing for those of us who either don't have kids. We can take the child and have them sit with us so that the parents can focus on the worship, and then we can help perhaps encourage the parents on how best to do this and help them. And we're a family, we're a Christian family, and we need to act like it. We need to make sure that we're all working together, and we're running really way past on time. One more thought. If a parent appears to be having difficulty, be the solution. Be the solution. Ladies, if you can, offer to take the child back to the nursery. If you can do that. Have a relationship with the mother or with the father, with the parents, and see if you can figure that out. Maybe we can assign someone to say, hey, if you need to take someone back to the nursery. Now, we don't want the nursery to be sort of a catch-all where the kids go regardless of behavior. I've seen that too, and that's not what we need. If they start to act up, then we can take them back to the nursery, or have them sit with another person where they might, because usually kids behave a bit better with someone who's not their parents. And so have them do that as well. I know Sam has taken Waylon a few times, and I'm sure that was helpful to Kathy. Depending on the age, perhaps you can sit with them again to help keep the child in line, or to offer to take the child to sit with you. In any event, these teachings that Jesus is teaching here will soon be put to the test, as we see next week in verse 38. Again, we're way past time, so I'm not going to ask for any final thoughts or comments. Thank you for your interaction, both on the live stream. I've seen a couple people make comments, and I appreciate that. And of course, with Sam as well. Again, thank you all for joining us. And we're going to start our live stream or our evening worship live stream in just a moment. Might be a little delayed because we're getting out of class a little late, but we'll get it started soon. Again, thank you all for joining us, and we'll see you in a moment. God bless.